We'd like to thank our sponsor, Purina Pro Plan, fuel for life. More sporting dog champions feed Pro Plan than any other brand of dog food.
Welcome back to another episode of Save for the Blind podcast. This is Carson Odegaard with my normal co-host, Jeff Smith. And today's guest, we have John Vion, who is UC Davis PhD student in ecology with an emphasis on wetlands and waterfowl, as well as Andy Atkinson, who is currently the Bird Haven Ranch manager and has some history in the past managing some of the wildlife areas in the state of California. We're going to talk about John's project that's got going on at Bird Haven right now, as well as Andy's background and what Andy does out here. And then maybe a little quick overview of Bird Haven Ranch. So welcome to the podcast, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, appreciate it. John, let's start with you. Just kind of give us your background and kind of what brought you to California and kind of the stuff that you're working on now.
All right. I'll try to give the brief overview. I grew up in a place called Texarkana, Arkansas. So if you ever listen to George Strait, All My Exes Live in Texas, that's mentioned there. I grew up there as a big duck hunter. All my buddies were big duck hunters, grew up hunting the timber. Then I went on to Hendricks College, where I started getting into research and working with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. So I started developing a love for, waterfowl research, but also the applied action for management. So after I did some research there in the McClung lab, I thought I wanted to go to med school for a little while, which kind of may play back into this project a little bit, but decided I was really interested in wildlife and waterfowl research. So I ended up going to the University of Arkansas Fayetteville and was in the Kremenz and De Gregorio lab, and I studied mallard body mass dynamics. So how are ducks changing in their size and weight based on what food they're getting? And so I did that all in Eastern Arkansas for about 2 to 3 years. And then I decided I didn't have enough. So I spoke to one of my mentors, Luke Naylor, who actually was in the John Eady lab in the early 2000s. He's now the chief of wildlife at Arkansas Game and Fish. And basically, I'd thrown some ideas around of different places I might want to go, and I knew I wanted to get my PhD. So he then called me one day and said, how about studying mosquitoes in California? And I was kind of like, what?
At that point, had you been to California before or seen the ducks that we had here? Or is that just totally foreign?
No. Yeah, I had not been out here. I mean, all I knew up until then at that point was some of the stuff I'd read about the Central Valley and then, San Francisco.
Yeah.
So I laugh because, to Arkansans, the mosquito might even be the state bird. So it was kind of funny to hear about those dynamics. And so I met with John Eady, and there was, as you'll learn in the podcast, there's a huge multi-collaborative team, including Andy here, that it's more than just mosquitoes. There's a lot that goes into the waterfowl habitat management and the wetland management. So it was really exciting. I got to be here, and now I'm about 4 summers in now. So yeah. So it's been fun. So
how close are you to wrapping up the PhD?
Oh, gosh. Probably. So this is the last big push of a field season, unless we find more things, which I'm sure we always can. But I'm looking probably at about 1.5 to 2 years in terms of wrap up. So got all the analysis and writing and all of that coming up soon. So now is all where the meat of everything starts to happen. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to remind everyone, when we talk about Eady and the Davis lab, so we're talking about John Eady at UC Davis, who we've had on the podcast in the past, semi-retired, kind of retired-ish, a couple more students.
tired again, as we say.
Andy, obviously you're a wealth of knowledge, but kind of tell everyone your background between working for the state and then now working for a private landowner.
Yeah, I went to work for California Department of Fish and Game in the Federal Hunt Program in 1984, and worked that back and forth between Sac, Delvin, Colusa, went to Grizzly Island. From Grizzly Island, I went to the Wildlife Investigation Lab, did wildlife relocation and disease work, and then in 1991, I transferred to Gray Lodge Wildlife Area, started there. Was at Gray Lodge Wildlife Area, Orville Wildlife Area, supervised the wildlife areas in the North Valley, and retired from California Department of Fish and Game in 2020. So I spent my entire career in wetlands. And right after I retired, Paul Bonderson asked if I would be interested in coming over here. And I got away from bureaucracy and COVID, paid for care, and I got to do science and wetland management again. So
yeah,
Paul was gracious enough to fund this PhD opportunity for John Vion and look at our integrated wetland management strategies and where we're trying to take advantage of what's available here and build on it to see how we can improve wetland management throughout the valley.
Yeah.
So it's pretty interesting. We're working really closely with our local Butte County Mosquito and Vector Control to look at opportunities and where we're lacking, how we can figure out better ways to do things. So it's been a great partnership. Paul and Sandy Bonderson have done a great job of making sure that the resources are available to get this done. And John's brought in grad students from all over the country, and they get to experience this California Central Valley. So it's been a great thing.
Yeah, no, it's exciting stuff. And Andy, can you speak to the difference? I mean, you were in the public sector or the government sector. Can you speak to how your job is so much different now, even though it was very tied into the same thing? Because we get a lot of people that complain, oh, the habitat on public areas aren't as good as private lands. But there's a reason for that for the most part. It's not necessarily the knowledge of the staff. There's so much other stuff behind it, budgets and those types of resources available for, like, you know, a public refuge.
Yeah. Well, you know, wetland management continues to evolve. It goes in circles back and forth what the emphasis is on. But each wildlife area was purchased for a specific reason. And if you look at Gray Lodge Wildlife Area, it was purchased under the Lee Act. So its primary purpose is to prevent depredation of agricultural crops by migratory birds. That's what it's there for. Everything else is added on and becomes secondary. So that's their primary goal. When you get into the Upper Butte Basin that was purchased later, you have Little Dry Creek and Howard Slough. They were purchased with different dollars. There's some T&E stuff there. There's the Central Valley Joint Venture implementation plan, but they're all part of the shrinking wetland acreages that are in this valley, and they're very important to a multitude of species in that those wetland acres are protected in perpetuity and part of the baseline for the OCAP biological opinion that allows water to be moved through the delta to support 30 million people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated. It changes, and, you know, there's always going to be a different emphasis on things. And, you know, it's more political science in biology than ecology and biology. So
yeah,
you're going to swing back and forth and go in different directions, and the emphasis is going to change, but the primary purpose at this point in time does not.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
And where we are currently sitting recording this is Birdhaven Ranch. And I know Paul did a pretty good description of Birdhaven Ranch when we had him on the podcast. Andy, if you want to give just a quick overview of when the ranch was acquired, how many acres it is, and what kind of currently takes place here, that'd be great.
Off the top of my head, I don't know when it was acquired. It's 2,500 acres. We have 899 acres of rice, and the rest is habitat. So about 1,500 acres of habitat, 200 acres of riparian upland habitat. It's along Howard Slough, in between Howard Slough and Butte Creek. It's south of the Howard Slough Wildlife Area, and it's west of the Little Dry Creek unit of the Upper Butte Basin Wildlife Area. So it's at the very north end of the Butte Basin.
Yeah, and we've done a bunch of events out here throughout the years. Obviously, our biggest is being college camp out here. We've done youth camps. We've had countless people shoot their first turkey, deer, ducks. So CWA has been involved with doing a lot of educational hunting classes and components out here. And just for, you know, what I crack up about is, you know, a lot of the dads that come out here, and we're sitting in the main clubhouse, and they're just, you know, it's like their Disneyland. Like, oh my gosh, this place is awesome. And the kids are having fun. But, you know, as an adult, you're looking around and you're like, you know, this place is impressive. Right. And just kind of being out here, habitat management side of it. It's a beautiful, beautiful property, beautifully maintained. So you kind of always feel like you're part of something when you're out here, which is always fun.
So kind of want to switch over a little bit to the scientific side and talk to John about his project. So obviously you had mentioned it had to do with mosquitoes. So what is the exact main purpose of the project?
Yeah, so I could give two sides of it. And, you know, I think this, I would, and Andy could probably attest to some of the history of it, but before I got here, but some of this stemmed from, you know, how can we get or optimize mosquito reduction, but also provide habitat, I would say, is one of the core things. And habitat for waterfowl, but also other wetland species. From a more researchy perspective, we don't do a good job of multi-objective management. So how do we meet the needs of multiple species, multiple people? So hunters and birders, you know, fishermen, there's different aspects of that that starts to play into how we make a management decision. Are the values of, you know, a wetland in a city versus the values of a wetland at Bird Haven, do those start to change? So how do we balance all of those things? One example I give a little bit is the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. Over the years is starting to try to incorporate more people. I think that the 2018 update did. And so it's starting to make that trajectory towards that. You know, we still kind of operate under the mallard umbrella, as I say. So whatever a mallard, if we can meet the needs of a mallard, we meet the needs of all other waterfowl. And, but you know, we're starting to see some challenges there with shorebirds and other things. So I'd say from the research side, that's kind of the big theoretical thing that we think about. But that leads me to the type of management we're doing here, which is integrated wetland management. So how can we re-engineer wetlands to include, you know, aspects of what used to be here? So not recreating what was here, but can we include elements of what was here to, you know, reduce mosquito production, provide waterfowl habitat, and provide the availability for wildlife use among multiple species. So I'd say that's kind of the whole, all pieces of the triangle in terms of the mission behind this project.
Yeah. And so you may know this, may not, not really sure. Is there an increase in mosquito production nowadays compared to what it used to be because of how we manage our wetlands currently?
So historically, I would be completely unsure on like the abundances back then. Yeah. I will say, you know, so one of the people, so part of the team that I work with, you know, Dr. John Eady, former Raveling chair. And then there's Dr. Danny Karp, who's a working land scientist. So those are both my co-advisors. And then Dr. Sharon Lawler, who's a mentor of mine. She was the entomologist / mosquito scientist for Davis for 40 years. And she said that in the valley, historically, there likely would have been pockets of, you know, hardcore mosquito production. And that's why people would get sick. But the dynamics back then, you would have had a lot more movement of up and down of water and probably more aquatic invertebrate predators, compared to some of the management practices that might be employed today. I mean, that's some of the stuff that we're hoping to study.
Yeah. Obviously there wasn't rice back then either. So
that'd yeah.
Well, and one of the things that you have to remember is through anthropocentric means, mm-hmm. we have flipped the water regime in California 180 degrees. We mm-hmm. went from 4 million acre yep. of wetland down to less than a million, right?
Yeah.
But we put all our water in traditionally for waterfowl in the fall.
Yep.
Okay. What would be naturally happening in the valley right now is all that water would be going down. Mm-hmm. There is no rain in the fall. Your wetlands would be shrinking. And you would be concentrating all of those inverts that you mm-hmm. produced all summer long. And the birds are showing up, whether they're neotropicals or early migrant pintails or shorebirds, to eat all of these macroinvertebrate. And they would be concentrating. So how do we put that back in? And that's what how we're looking at integrated wetland management is how do we put that function back in to mimic an i.e. natural cycle?
Mm-hmm.
But use it with the resources that are available to us to maximize wetland habitat and associated other habitats for all species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'd probably say to add to that, to for people listening to see how severe that flip is. I think wetland assessments suggest in the state of California that about 7 to 10% of naturally functioning wetlands actually remain. So it shows you how much like the human has to, you know, try to be involved in that function that used to be here.
Absolutely. And can you guys speak to, you know, the mosquito abatement and fees and what the mosquito vector control, you know, the limitations they put on some landowners because they may or may not have the funds. They might want to put water on right now, but, you know, they won't get fined after, what is it, October 8th or 9th or whatever it is. So a lot of managers wait, you know, and they don't flood up in the summer or don't irrigate. And can you guys kind of speak to that of kind of the controlling aspect of the mosquito vector control?
You want to add on that and I can throw in the science? I mean,
at Bird Haven Ranch here, we work really closely with Butte County Mosquito and Vector Control, Matt Ball and Aaron, and their aides to ensure that what we're doing isn't creating a human health issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with West Nile, management strategy change, you know, we went a little bit one direction. Now we need to go another direction. And we're developing strategies that work with our local mosquito and vector control agency to optimize management of our wetlands to reduce mosquito production, at the same time enhancing macroinvertebrate and the species that depend on those macroinvertebrates to get through their life cycles. So it's been a great partnership. John's been here for 4 years now of it. I've been working with Matt and Butte County Mosquito and Vector since I was at Gray Lodge. It, you know, sometimes it's frustrating, but it's frustrating on both sides.
Yeah.
So we have to work to find, you know, the place in the middle so that we can both achieve our public trust resource goals. And theirs is human health protection and reduction of vectors. And ours is producing the best available wetlands for a multitude of species. So that's what we're trying to do at Bird Haven Ranch. And Paul and Sandy Bonderson have done a great job of allowing us to do that. And we're letting the science dictate where we go and not how we feel.
Yeah.
So, right. You know, too much of how we feel we make decisions on instead of looking at the science and saying, okay, this works, this didn't. And, you know, hopefully in the end, when we're done with this, we're going to be able to show that our wetland management strategies have not only reduced the nuisance mosquitoes that we could be producing, but we're enhancing the health of the wetlands for all species on a year-round basis. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, what I mean is the connectivity in wetlands are so geographically segmented now. What we're going to try to do on Bird Haven Ranch is connect all of our units so that as one's coming up, one's going down, so that we're always producing new generations of macroinvertebrates for all the species that depend on them. And that's where John's coming in and looking at eDNA of the birds and what they're eating, at the same time taking invert samples and seeing what we're producing. Mm-hmm. Is there a correlation there?
Mm-hmm.
So the bug part of it hasn't been looked at really heavily throughout the United States. And, you know, Bird Haven Ranch, UC Davis, John are right on the forefront of making it happen and showing how important this is. And then he just added the plant part of it. You know, everybody looks out there, says it's a great smartweed field, right?
Yeah.
How many types of smartweed are there in California? Do you know the difference between a perennial smartweed and an annual smartweed? You know, the annuals put their life cycle into producing seeds. The perennials put their life cycle into producing biomass. But if you look at all of our models, they have smartweed as one single entity.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But we know from the stuff that John's done and just by observation, if we're promoting annuals, we're producing more food.
Yeah. So like speaking to that, are you, you know, with the perennials, are you seeing like bug use in certain plants higher or lower? I mean, how does that?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So using our pilot data, I guess I could give a little bit on like how long we've been doing this.
Let's dive into that.
So like in 2022, I came in for a pilot season. So again, like getting back to like how generous Paul has been, we're the amount of resources, not only to go into supporting me, but like, I think we've had 12 technicians come through this project, which is a bit unheard of. Most people have one, maybe one and a half, like through a season. And we're doing research at the landscape scale. So we're comparing treatment controls. So when you think about our experimental, you know, go back to high school science, you have one unit you're comparing your new management in to the traditional management, which would have been these 10-day irrigations mm-hmm. that was through the joint venture I have been developed, best management practices. And so what we've done is we compared those two units, and in the pilot year, Paul was kind enough to front some funds so I could come in and I basically, you know, run all over the place and just see what works, what doesn't. What was fun about that was we collected a bunch of pilot data that, you know, was haphazard with bugs, haphazard with plants. I remember thinking like, oh, how am I going to see any trends? Cause we're adjusting things as we go, so that in 23, 24 and 25, we could hit the ground running really hard with our sampling. We saw some, you know, some signals among those bugs. One of the ones I thought that I would see was, you know, differences in vegetative height and composition. So one of the things we, you know, tend to see anecdotally with mosquitoes is they like to cluster in that Bermuda grass. And also when you have areas of lower elevation where that water gets, you know, can't get out, sometimes you get patches of Bermuda grass that grow. And compared to the value of, you know, smartweed or other your other plants, you may not want that. And also it produces mosquitoes, so you start to have a disease issue. So I thought I would start to see some composition trends there. I didn't in the pilot data. Now, in 2023 and 2024, we did some ocular assessments of vegetation. So this is now we're coming into the year where we're like, okay, we got all the errors out of the way. We're, you know, running right into everything that's fine tuned. So we did some ocular assessments that were actually developed by Luke Naylor in the early 2000s. And essentially they had correlated biomass of seeds to this ocular thing you do where, and what I mean by that is I go out to a field, a certain area, I give a seed size score and I give a plant percentage score, those kinds of things. And what we noticed was there was a better production score for smartweed and watergrass in the integrated units in 23 and 24. But there was kind of nuanced with bulrush and some of the grasses. So in 23, it seemed like there was some overlap in terms of what we call confidence in better production. In 2024, which was a hotter year, there seemed to be some better production in integrated units in those plants. So where I'm getting at with all of this is we haven't necessarily run the statistics on what the difference of other plants. So we're talking about mare's tail. We're talking about cocklebur, velvet leaf, your other, some of the invasives there, how those fit into the story and how those actually affect mosquitoes as well as all these other predators. Because there's likely there could be some two-way relationships going on where plants affect certain insect communities. And some insect communities have adaptations to alter those plants. And that starts to get into a whole nother story with wetland quality, but yeah. So a long-winded way to say don't know just yet, but there's some exciting trends that we've seen with our non-pilot data that suggests there could be some interesting stuff going on.
And can you go into the management plan? We talked about the 10-day traditional wetland management, you know, put water on for 10 days, kill mm-hmm. the cocklebur, drain it, whatever. What are you guys doing differently now with in terms of like the water? Like, is it on all summer? Is it never drying up? Like, what's the difference?
Yeah, so I'd say, so in terms of, you know, what we compared to specifically with the, you know, best management practices, it was there were these 10-day irrigations where you do full flood up, you hold it for 10 days, and then you drop it. I think kind of the biology that we were thinking about with the mosquitoes, so it starts to get into why we do some of our practices I'll lead into, is a mosquito in hot optimal temperatures can go from egg to adult in about 4 to 5 days. So there's different groups of mosquitoes, but this is the 80s. So the one that lays its eggs in the mud. So that's the nuisance one you get bit by all the time during the summer. There is the Culex and Anopheles, and they are your, so Culex is the West Nile transmitter and Anopheles is malaria. Don't have malaria in California that has been detected, but, West Nile is the big kicker. Those can develop in about 7 to 10 days. So when you think about accomplishing plant goals, you know, just in general, just talking about water right now, you could produce mosquitoes in that period of time. So for, if the temperatures are hot enough, so that starts to get into the semantics of, will you get sprayed or not?
Yeah, that's why you get sprayed.
Right. So then if you move into, the plant dynamics a little bit, you know, a lot of these annual plants are more sensitive to water. So they do not want to be flooded for a longer period of time. We've stuck with a 5-day flood up for now. There's potentially some plants, like I think a swamp timothy, if you've got a timothy field, I wouldn't go more than 24 hours on that. So, you know, there's some flexibility of going lower than 5 days, but for the sake of the experiment, we keep it at 5 for like our annual smart weeds and things like that. So essentially now you're reducing the flood time. You're doing a shorter full irrigation. The other kicker here with the mosquito biology is that there tends to be offs of mosquitoes or production of larvae when you have drying cycles. And as Sharon has described to me, there's basically a switch in the egg that when oxygen changes, so when you go from wet mud where they lay eggs, so thinking about 80s here, that water goes over top and your oxygen is changing. So you went from wet mud to dry mud to water hatch. That starts to happen. So kind of some of the ideas here that Andy can also attest to is, you know, if we can keep water in the swales of the wetlands, so, you know, not flooding out those plants all the time, but it's some of these more bare dirt areas, if we can keep water in there, we can increase the soil moisture. You also, and so that's happened, the swale water is, you know, we're bringing that water back to the swale and we're allowing ourselves to keep that water throughout the summer. For most of the summer. So already I'm thinking between the traditional management, we had about 2 10-day periods, so 20 days of water. Your integrated units could have approximately 140 days of access. So now you start to think about your aquatic invert predators that can prey on mosquitoes. So some of these predators are short-lived, but some like dragonflies, there are some that can live 3 months before they turn to an adult. So, and they're some of the most efficient predators. So getting back to the integrated piece, we have the wet swales. We do shorter irrigations. One of the other big things is swale maintenance. So beginning of the season, you know, making sure that our swales don't have a lot of vegetation in them. So you think about running water over a slide versus a carpet. You want to run it over the slide because you have more control, right? That doesn't mean going through and mowing all your wet plants down, but in the areas where you need that water to go quickly, you have more control over it. And that's going to reduce mosquito issues and also plant issues if you get invasives. I think the one final thing I left out was being able to put water on by looking at both plants or looking at what your plant structure is doing. So if you're starting to get a lot of cocklebur and velvet leaf and it's real hot outside, now's a good time to throw that water on because you can use the heat in the water to drown it really quickly, especially if it's small. Because if it starts to get above, it'll start to grow. So I guess we're, I don't mean to get overly complicated, but kind of the big piece here with the integrated management is we're constantly looking. There's no recipe to it, as opposed to traditional management plans are based on a lot of calendars and, you know, how long to keep water on at a certain depth, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
How many different types of mosquitoes are we talking about here?
Oh, gosh. You know, in terms of, so I would say in terms of the different genus groups, we have those three. So you've got Aedes, Culex, and Anopheles. Of the species groups, gosh, I can think of maybe 6 or 7. Sometimes getting a species can be really tough. So you're starting to get under a microscope and look at differences in hairs. And
mosquito was a mosquito over here.
So there's difference. And what's kind of cool is the mosquito, each of those mosquitoes and the different diseases they transmit, they've somewhat evolved to live different lifespans to be able to transmit that mosquito. So the cool fact is, you know, Aedes puts their eggs in the mud, and they're typically shorter lived. And their eggs can survive in that dry soil for a long period of time until it's wet. Your Culex and Anopheles, they can actually hibernate in the winter. So they put less energy into their eggs, and they lay little rafts of eggs on the water and wet vegetation. But they can actually slow themselves down through the winter. So I always joke, if you get a warm day during the winter and you get bit, it could be one of those. Anyone.
That makes sense.
You might be the guy for my next question. So my dad was a fly fisherman. And he used to wear like this dragonfly sound or something. I don't know. How many mosquitoes are dragonflies? Like, how many do they eat in a day?
Oh gosh. That, so I think it varies. Yeah. This is where I love having my conversations with Sharon. So most of the stuff I read online is like 100 a day.
Yeah.
And that's a speaking like adult dragonfly and adult mosquito. Yeah. And that's a lot. I've even read, there's a predatory beetle we collect pretty commonly. Predatory diving beetle. So it looks like a little copper round beetle, zips around. You may see it come up to the top of the water and then go down really quick. I have read from, I think it was out of Cincinnati, but there is a study that said that their larva could eat upwards of 700 mosquito larvae until it becomes an adult. And so but where it gets into the semantics is, how big are the mosquito larvae? And, you know, same thing with dragonflies. How big are the mosquitoes the dragonflies eating? What kind of dragonfly? There's, you know, I think we have 11 different types of dragonflies we collect out here. So, you know, it kind of it starts to average out, but they do have a very high predatory rate. I think it's like they catch 95% of the stuff they pursue.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Pretty gnarly.
Something every day. Hunting season is right around the corner. Go to calwaterfowl.org to check out all of our opportunities through our hunt program. That's deer, duck, goose, pheasant, dove, wild pig, and a whole lot more. Go to calwaterfowl.org to find the hunt that's right for you. When you're there, check out our new membership deal. Buy a CWA regular membership and receive a free 80th year anniversary CWA t-shirt. Also, check out some of our events we have coming up. September 24th, we have our Riverside CWA recruitment and social. We have the Placerville County Banquet on October 2nd, the Intermountain Banquet on October 3rd, and the Petaluma Banquet also on October 3rd. Go to calwaterfowl.org to support us today. Thank you. So, Andy, in terms of keeping the water on in the swales, how are you guys managing like primrose and some of the other, you know, stuff that's popping up? Are you seeing any, you know, an increase of that?
No, actually, we're seeing a reduction in that.
Oh,
and
nice.
How we're doing it is we're slowly learning and adapting. And if you remember, when we had all that acreage of wetlands in the valley, we didn't have the levees. So you had all of these connecting sloughs and ponds and everything. And that contributed to how everything evolved here. So what we're trying to do is mimic that. So what our goal is we want every unit to have a swale, a slough, or a creek, whatever you want to call it, and that all of them have a pond or two in it. And that's just at a different level than your seasonal wetland. We're not leveling our wetlands. We're contouring them to the swales. We're cutting our swales from top to bottom and then getting the best velocities we can get, given the nature of the valley. And then we go to the bottom end or in the middle if it's a big field, and we cut something that's 18 inches lower than the rest of the pond. So now we have that slough going through. You have a pond, and you're concentrating and letting it go up and down all summer long. So you're producing the predators. Remember, mosquitoes can go from zero to adult in 5 days in above 90 degree temperature. Mm-hmm. Your predators are 7 to 28 days. Some of your dragonflies are 120 days. If we just do 10-day irrigations, 5-day irrigations, mm-hmm. the only thing we're ever going to have is mosquitoes.
Right.
We're not producing all the other stuff. We're not letting them complete their life cycle. Remember, in the floodwater mosquitoes, they have to lay their egg in mud. That mud has to dry before they're viable. That's why they're floodwater mosquitoes. Once it's dry completely and the water comes back over them, they start hatching out. Well, there's nothing there if you don't have these sloughs to concentrate. So by getting the correct slopes on your swales, and contouring things to your swale and letting it go up and down, you're producing generations of macroinvertebrate every day, mm-hmm. sometimes twice a day. Look at the nurseries of the world. They're are tidal marshes, right? Because you get a new life cycle twice a day.
Yeah.
Land or sea. So it makes it very interesting. The other thing it is by putting them that way, when we go to irrigate a field, that moisture has already gone laterally subsurface.
Mm-hmm.
So we can flood it faster, mm-hmm. bring it down faster.
Yep.
So we can look at the plants, and when whether it's cocklebur or velvet leaf, as soon as they're a half inch to an inch and a half, 2 inches high, if we can get the water over them quickly, we can get rid of them in a day, 2 days.
Right.
Okay, now you bring all of those nutrients back down into the swale. You're feeding your macroinvertebrate at the bottom or in the center where you have these ponds located. So now you start taking that from one unit to the next, and you start getting that connectivity back where you're not only moving water, but you're moving nutrients. At the same time, you're providing feeding habitat for black phoebes, for yellow-billed cuckoos, brood habitat for ducks, invertebrates for quail and pheasant, turkeys. So you're starting to get this cycle to where it's actually functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And you're managing it on a year-round basis now. At the same time, you're maximizing your carbohydrate production through your divorce moisture soil plants.
Yeah, and in terms of like the management, are you at a, in terms of costs, a net zero, a positive, negative in terms of this current management and what historic wetland managers have always done?
I think that we'll get the answers to that next year.
Mm-hmm.
We've been looking at the biology about it, and because it's a 5-year study, we can't change anything right now because
mm-hmm.
we have the pest plots and the controls. So we couldn't change anything for 5 years, even though we've learned things. And we have some fields that are not in the study that are looking really good. And we'll start looking at those. And then we can start doing the net cost analysis on mm-hmm. what's better. I mean, is it when you look at herbicides and chemical and all that to control velvet leaf and cocklebur, Bermuda,
mm-hmm.
if your management strategy and your use of water and your field designs negate that and lessen it, you're going to be money ahead. Mm-hmm. If you're using, you know, if it takes a heck of a lot of water to flood a dry field.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. it does. Okay? If you have moisture going through it.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's just take an example. We have the North 280 up here. That was a control. So it was a 2 10-day irrigations.
Mm-hmm.
Run the pump 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 8 days to get it there, right?
Right.
Then you dry it out. You wait 30, 45 days. That soil moisture goes down. You run it 24 hours a day again, right? Well, look at what PG&E costs now.
Yeah.
It's not about the kilowatt hours anymore. It's about the demand charges.
If rates aren't going down.
Yeah, they're not going down. And you may be using less kilowatts, but because you're pumping during certain times of the day, mm-hmm. those demand charges go way up. And with those demand charges, if you go 1 minute into the demand period, it automatically applies to all 31 days in that month. So it's very interesting when you're looking at your PG&E usage is going down. At the same time, your PG&E costs are going up. So that's a really interesting strategy we're looking at is, given this management, can we run our pumps from 10 at night till 10 in the morning or noon, keep it at that 28 cents a kilowatt,
mm-hmm.
instead of going to $14 a kilowatt, $80 a kilowatt based on your horsepower and the demand.
Right.
So those are things you can't foresee. But when you have a recipe that says turn it on for 10 days and get it on, well, what if you can just run that pump at night when you're cheap?
Mm-hmm.
Things get better. Okay. At the same time, when you're running it at night, it turns off during the day, that whole swale and pond, because of how it's designed, you get those mud banks where things are running, laying their eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Next day it comes up, you create a new generation. With the velocities that we have and the way we design, we're pushing everything down to the bottom in the centers so that we have the predators there. So even when we go to irrigate in our fields, when you irrigate it, you're pushing all of those larvae that are just eggs. They're really small. You don't see a whole lot of mosquitoes in flowing bodies of water because it pushes them down. They don't have the energy to get up out of that flow. So we're pushing them down into a feedlot of predators, and those larvae are getting eaten. They're tumbling. They drown.
Yeah.
There's all different. The biology of the mosquito, we're taking advantage of its biology. At the same time, we're increasing the productivity of our wetlands. So mm-hmm. hopefully, John, when he gets all this, it'll work out and we did something right. You know, one thing I found in a marsh. Some of our best successes are failures, and some of our worst failures end up being a success. It's just how much you look at it and mm-hmm. over time. And what we have to remember is, as humans, we always want a wetland or anything, your dad, anything to look the same. That's how we want it to look. But in order to make it function, we have to disturb it to start new processes, so that we meet the needs of all these species. So that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's the integrated wetland management approach, is that we're there to constantly do disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
At the
mm-hmm.
same time, we're looking at how the disturbance reacts, and we're looking at negative plants versus positive plants mm-hmm. and when to put water on. And it changes every year. I can't give you a date. We look at it and see what germs.
Yeah.
This year, we had watergrass germing in March. Going, uh-oh. Yeah. So, you know, if you're, the thing about management is, if you can't manage from a desk.
No.
You have to get out there and be looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can take advantage of all these plants when they're small.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. If they get bigger, you mm-hmm. lose.
On your 5-day flood ups, are you getting just as much production of smartweed and watergrass as when you're having your 10-day holds?
I would say we're getting more.
Yeah. So based on some of the visual assessments we've done, there seems to be signals that on the integrated units, the smartweed and watergrass seems to have better production.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so that starts to get into a little bit too, you know, Andy mentioned earlier, there's different types of smartweed. If you go out there, just some general ones you look at, there's the big thumb shaped ones. And then there's some that kind of look like little like dangly hairs hanging down. And so smaller seeds, maybe more seeds, you know, we don't know. That's what we're doing right now. We actually collect seed heads. I think I was doing the math last night. I think we'll have collected close to 10,000 seed heads by the end of this project. And so we weigh how much biomass is in each of those. And so we're going to hopefully get, you know, some yield per acre estimates at some point. Wow. So should have some more fine scale stuff soon, but yeah.
That's cool. And in terms of the water, is it all through wells, or is it district water, or coming from the creek? And if there is different, are you guys seeing production in units that are fed by a well versus fed by, you know, Butte Creek water?
We have all of the above.
Yeah.
So we have deep wells. As you are well aware, deep wells are very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
We tend not to use them when we have our lift pumps and our district water from Western Canal Water District. So, and because the ranch is linear, we're using our water from the north side of the ranch all the way to the south side of the ranch. And we're currently developing additional strategies to enhance and make that more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
When this study is complete, we'll be able to go from unit to unit. But we're also looking at, hopefully with next year or the year after, looking at temperature variance within our swales and our ponds and seeing how the impacts of using 52 degree water from mm-hmm. a deep well versus
right.
lift pumps and that, and what that impact is on macroinvertebrate and plant production.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is that they're wetlands. If there's no water, they're just a dry upland mm-hmm. and we lose. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is true with, I heard someone talking about this the other day about noticing ducks using units fed by well versus lift, differently. And, one of the things I go back to is the invertebrates, because as Andy mentioned, that colder water can actually slow down right. production pretty, I won't say severely, but like it can extend the days that it takes to develop, for some invertebrates. So you may not see as much initial production and maybe slower, your community might change mm-hmm. as opposed to if you're starting with what 70-80 degree water, you know, those bugs start moving fast. So then birds are going to probably concentrate on those a lot quicker. So I'm hoping with some of the future stuff that we might be able to try and compare. We've used a lot of lift pump because I think that's a little more, well, it's cheaper, but also yeah. more relatable to, you know, what people might be using in the valley. So
yeah. I think that brings me to a question that's been kind of boiling in my head, relatability and other people in the valley. Obviously, this is a large scale ranch that has funding, has a PhD student. And you were talking about how, like, you know, you have to be out there, look at it. It doesn't need to be flooded for 5 days at that point. What are we doing? How feasible is this for other landowners in the area? You know, we are lucky enough at CWA to have somebody that might be out at our wetlands 3, 4, 5 times a week, but maybe mm-hmm. somebody might own a 100-acre piece and they go out there like once a month. It just doesn't seem, at least this, what we're talking about, isn't the best method for them, but could be used potentially in the future.
Mm-hmm. I'd probably say, you know, again, kind of gets back to our mantra of integrated wetland management. What we've done here, I kind of, you know, look at this like Andy's the doctor and the wetlands are the patients, right? So each wetland does not need the same thing. Sometimes Andy may go out and, you know, for the sake of the experiment, I'll say we've controlled some things, but sometimes in the non-study wetlands, he goes out and sees Timothy. He's like, ooh, I don't want to flood that for more than 24 hours. So I'm going to pull that water off. Now, you know, I need to be a little more careful with that wetland as opposed to maybe North 280 where you're flooding that one up longer and you kind of let the pump run kind of thing. I think it helps for you to be constantly observing, because what if a beaver plugs up something and you weren't there for 3 or 4 days?
No, beavers don't do that.
Yeah, right.
Relocate it.
Yeah. So there's some, you know, pieces of that puzzle that, you know, we have some luxuries being able to do that out here, and not everyone's going to have the same level of resources probably. But I also think, though, that doesn't mean you can't still use pieces of this based on your situation. Yeah. And I think that gets back to the integrated piece. It's understanding what your goals are, what your constraints are. Us not giving you a recipe, but giving you what has worked for us.
Right.
Well, and the other thing is you have to look at how we're doing it. We're not going in there and starting over from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're looking at it. Take South Marsh number one. It took us 2.5 years to get it to where we wanted it. And because of all the riparian trees and everything that are in some of these units, we had to scratch our head to make it work. And, you know, things that have happened in the past are sometimes negative. And, you know, 5-10 years from now, someone may say everything we're doing right now.
These guys were idiots.
This guy was crazy. Why did he do this? But, you know, we've come up with some pretty good things. You know, if you look at it, a lot of people, when they start doing restoration efforts, they go in and completely start from scratch, you know, basically taking a rice field and we're going to convert it back. It's perfectly level. How are we going to do this? They put, you know, some swales, some ponds, some low spaces in it, not thinking about, okay, what's this going to end up doing to me?
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing is, you know, we're not engineers. Me and the staff go out. We take the pond up to full shoot level. We put in stakes and we take paint and we paint them. We bring it down. We go and measure and we go, okay, this is what we have to work with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We bring in a construction company, dirt moving company with scrapers and go, okay, we want water from the top to the bottom. Well, it can't be straight because of all the riparian trees and stuff. So we start looking at how do we keep those deep swales away from the recreational areas?
Yeah.
And how do we make it work the best? So we put in a swale in there the first year and kind of worked up. We better do some changes to it. Can we get more slope in? And it wasn't there. And then we went in and we built on the second year, we put in the predator nursery at the bottom, and it was the biggest one so far.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut it down all the way up, and it absolutely looks phenomenal this year, but it took 2.5 years to get there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, because we have a working ranch. We have recreation. We have species that we're trying to manage for. To go in and just nuke something and start all over,
mm-hmm.
that takes a year away.
Right.
So you can do this in pieces. And when you start looking at how we're doing things, you'll find out your management is a lot easier if you do all of your disturbance in the fall. You need less water to manage things. You're promoting diverse moist soil plants of smartweed and watercress because you're disturbing the soil seed bank. When you go in and do this in the spring and summer and do your disking, the first thing you're going to start seeing is cocklebur and velvet leaf and Bermuda grass. And you're going to go, whoa, I went wrong. Well, now you have to put on water, another thing of water just to get rid of that.
Hmm.
So if you look at it, if you start looking at how we use the ecology of the valley that and how it evolved, we do our disturbances in the fall and winter.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do our drawdowns. You start looking at stuff and you start looking, hey, I'm starting to get what I want and I'm having less efforts.
Mm-hmm.
And you think the swales are a lot of work. We run a mower down the sides of them. Before we flood them up, we take herbicide, go down the sides and middle. We flood them up. That's it. You know, and as long as you have the right velocity and drop in your swale, you're not going to get the primrose. You're not going to get that stuff. The mm-hmm. primrose and all of these non-native exotic plants are where you hold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you have that little hold of water on, that's where they get a foothold and they just start creeping.
Right.
Well, if we can keep those velocities where we're, whether it's a Zola, primrose, parrot's feather, any of them, we push them from top and out the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer our problem. They're somebody else's.
Those are all Jeff's favorites.
Good old Zola. Talk about a nightmare as a duck hunter, manager. But
a Zola doesn't like flow.
Yeah, but you remember a couple years ago in the drought, and then the water came and just the tire butte scene just
turned
took it all.
Yeah,
it was terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, good old Zola. We were lucky. It kind of went through us and to some other folks. But I know some other
we were at the bottom of the chain.
Yeah, I know some other clubs like it literally ruined their entire duck season. Like you just can because it, you know,
you can't.
You guys know in the right conditions, it just keeps tripling or whatever every day.
We had one unit that was at South Marsh. One was it, or was it two that year? It was during the hunt camp. It took
South
over.
Marsh one, yeah.
And before it got turned into more of an integrated unit, it had a lot of Azolla in it. It was crazy.
But Azolla is going to develop in backwaters where there isn't flow. So if, once again, if
you hold
it's not about leveling it, it's about getting that flow so you don't have that mm-hmm. backwater. And then when your pump, you know, your pumps are picking it up out of the sloughs and it's getting in the pond. But if that goes right into the swale and it takes it straight to the bottom and out.
Mm-hmm.
You start seeing it build up. All you have to do is pull boards and off it goes.
Yeah.
Right.
If you have these areas that are like this, where you have all that topography, it gets stranded in the topography and you start to expand.
Yep.
You know, what people don't understand about Azolla, in right conditions, it doubles every 24 hours.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something if you keep an eye on, it's you can manage for it and get rid of it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not keeping an eye and you come up once a month and look at it and go, my decoy is.
Yeah, we got an issue.
Whoa, we got a problem.
Yeah.
That's duck food, right? I mean, you guys are obviously super passionate about what you do in this project, but what excites you the most at the end of the project, what you could hopefully show, you know, the successes of this?
Yeah, so I'd probably say, like, for me, you know, well, one, the opportunity just to be out here and evaluate this, right? So to get to work with guys like Andy and also Rich Pence, who's manager out here, and Paul, even to have that investment and support to basically try to train me in any way feasibly possible on wetland management, has been very exciting for me. And also my research team at Davis, my mentors there. But you know, I think kind of a big thing, and I'm sure everyone here would agree, is, you know, I'm a duck hunter. We're all duck hunters. And I think, you know, growing up in Arkansas too, like, I'm just very passionate about that. It's just something I was doing since a young age. And to have an opportunity to not only dedicate a portion of what I get to do, but also my dissertation to help preserve that, or preserve opportunity for people, and for new hunters, that drives me every single day. So if I got to learn everything about a mosquito to do that, I for sure will. So that's probably what excites me a lot.
Are you going to be a transplant?
A transplant.
Arkansas to California boy?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. As John said, you know, this year we start talking about my career moves, John said, so who knows where I end up. Jeff gave me a quick plug, I hear.
What are you most excited about, Andy?
The thing that really gets excited is looking at the diversity of the wetland and the quality of wetlands and how they're improving over time. Mm. You know, we've only been at this 4 years, but you can see species response. Mm-hmm. And we're still in that segmented portion of test and control. Mm-hmm. What's really going to be neat is when this is all linked together and you have that historic connectivity and function as things are going up and things are going down, and see all the species that react to it. Mm-hmm. You know, that you see not only the species that are reacting to it, but the plants, the flora that are reacting to it. And you're going, oh, maybe I got it right. Mm-hmm. But like I said, 10 years from now, some manager may come along and say, boy, you were totally wrong.
I think it's all great. I mean, you know, go back to mosquito vector control. Anytime you can get sprayed less is good when they don't have to come over you. We had one day right before the season started and they had to do their job. They flew over and we lost all of our ducks. It was like 2 or 3 days before the duck season. And, you know, on us for the water issue or how we had it flooded, but it's their job
before the opener.
Oh boy.
Could have done ducks it on bye bye after the opener, but yeah, that was tough.
And then you get a bill and it's like, you know, if you can manage that, like you talked about, and maybe the other costs end up actually being lower than the bill from the mosquito vector control, then sign me up.
You know, the good thing is if we're working with mosquito and vector control, mm-hmm. and we can solve each other's problems, mm-hmm. right? And benefit both.
Oh, I'm sure they're stoked about this.
We're doing great.
Yeah.
So, you know, I give credit to them. They're working with us. We're learning from them. They're showing us, you know, some of the things we were doing wrong, some of the things we're doing right. We're looking at how the interactions between the macroinvertebrate and the mosquito larva and the adults are doing, you know, how do we make it work? Yeah. And because if we just take the wall approach, we're just going to do it our way. They've got the bigger hammer. So, you know, we lose in the end. Because the bottom line is, if you go to a city and you say, how many of you want to get rid of mosquitoes? They're all going to vote, get rid of mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to do it. And, you know, there's another piece of the equation that a whole lot of wetland managers don't think about is if agriculture goes away, the infrastructure that supplies all of that water to our wetlands, who's going to maintain that? Mm-hmm. So, you know, one thing that's unique about, and if you look at all of our wetland areas, they're at the bottom of agricultural basins.
Right.
And if we got to figure out how keep agriculture working in California to support the migratory birds we have coming. You know, it's shorebirds, it's eagles, they're everything. They all do that migration and they've been doing it for eons. Mm-hmm. We tend to think short term, how do we make it work long term so that we have that function back that maximizes the diversity of our habitat and the quality of our habitat for what we have left.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, to add to some of that too, like just, kind of working with all of these other agencies, that's something that's also really fun for me is like, you know, we may all have different goals, but trying to find that sweet spot Andy talked about. And, you know, a big props to vector control is like, their technicians come out. We text almost every day about whether it's water going on or off. How long? What is it? Is it a mud flat? Is it not? And they let us know when they're when they want to come out and survey. And even more so, I have a group message with their technicians and my technicians, and our techs get to go out and actually sample with them and see how they're doing things and learn what are the proper ways, what are the things that they do. Again, it gets back into like, how does that relate to how we do the sciencey side of things? You know, what are they, what are the challenges they're having to deal with on a day-to-day basis? And at the end of the day, I've spoken to some vector officials that, you know, they're duck hunters too. And they, as you kind of pointed out, like they don't want to have to come out all the time. And, you know, I heard one story where someone was concerned about, you know, they want to get their kid involved in hunting. And so if there's a way or an avenue in which not only can we reduce mosquito production to optimize habitat and opportunity, they were excited about that to do so. So I think that it's some of those stories you don't really hear, but that it gets exciting when you start to find those parallels and you get to work with an agency. And like Andy said, you know, sometimes we have to figure out how to navigate if they need to come in and spray or we need to alter our management somehow and learn from each other. I think that that's where the magic happens. So it's that part's a lot of fun.
In terms of your project, are you guys tied into anything else you guys are doing out here with like the wood duck program and tagging of the ducks? How does that
relate to this project? Yeah, so I can mention that. That's actually kind of the one of the fun pieces too as well. So you know, we're studying bugs, we're studying plants. One of the other things is, again, I'm a duck hunter, and so I get interested in the waterfowl piece, but I'm also interested in wetland wildlife. So what we've done with the wood duck program over the last few years, undergrads out of Davis would come up and, you know, they would band ducks. They come up like once a week, so to speak. And we actually, something I wanted to do in Arkansas when I did my mallard work, but I didn't have the time or funds, was take fecal samples from birds and actually get the genetic information on what you're eating. So most of the foods, well, I'd say for invertebrates, there's a lot of invertebrates that a duck digests right in the esophagus. You'll never see it if you cut them open. So that's challenging. And that also may skew like what actually is a nutrient the bird's getting. So when you use fecal matter, you get all the genetic material, which is kind of the new technology. So what we did over the last three or four years, as the wood duck crews went around, I sent them out with little vials and I said, you know, if the ducks poop on you almost every time, they would put them in a bag as you're banding them. It's also less stress for the bird, you know? So, they usually poop in the bag, get that sample, put it in a vial. And so we have all this genetic information on what they're eating, with hopes of actually tying that back to the management. Are we seeing boxes near integrated units with what we're finding on the ground? Do we see diet shifts?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for the body condition of that duck? Did she have more ducklings? You know, these are questions I have all the time.
There's so much to it.
And then, you know, so we've done that. What's been exciting, I'd say, over the last, well, it was technically three, but we went full Monty on it this summer, was we actually have been collaborating with USGS to put telemetry backpacks on some of these wood ducks, which has been a whole learning process for me. But to actually, because the next question is, okay, you're taking poop from a duck near a wetland on a box, but could it have been at Little Dry Creek the entire time? We don't know. So we want to track their movement. And kind of the hope there is we can get information while they're on the nest, while they're moving, multiple poop samples, you get the picture, while the management's going on. So we get kind of a lens through that wood duck. We also, the benefit of the telemetry stuff. So this is all the GPS trackers for those listening. We can get winter information. So is there cross-seasonal effects of the management? Which leads me, I guess, in the final wildlife use piece, which is game cameras. So I grew up using those for deer a lot, but a lot of people I grew up use them in their private land to see if ducks were using duck holes and things. And so I was like, I've done some game camera stuff before. Maybe we could track use with game cameras. And it's pretty amazing anecdotally, you know, the use you get in the integrated units where normally that would have been a dry wetland. You see broods, you're seeing wood duck use. And then in the winter you get all sorts of cool duck photos from those cameras. So we've been tracking wildlife use year round as well. So that's all like stuff that I'll be analyzing over the next year. So a lot of stuff. But it'll be really fun to see that output, which is what a lot of people see, you know, on the landscape. So,
well, and you want to make understand that you're not only looking at wildlife use, looking at abundance and diversity.
Exactly.
Because those cameras are there taking a picture every 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. So when you get those drawdowns where you're concentrating those quails and those inverts, you know, you just thought there were this many species. But what we're finding out is there's a whole suite of species that are using that mm-hmm. that we weren't recognizing.
Yep.
So that's going to be some really good data.
Right.
Going to show some. That, you know, once again, the more diverse our wetlands and the better they're managed, the more diversity of the wildlife we're going to mm-hmm. get there.
Yeah.
I do have a really cool photo. Maybe I can share it sometime as a turkey fan deep in our predator pond picking bugs out of
there. No kidding.
Yeah. It's actually happened on multiple occasions, but
that's awesome.
Shows you what kind of stuff that camera picks up. But
yeah, I bet. Well, it sounds like you're going to need some more help out here with all that data.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, what's funny is you talk about, you know, not noticing stuff that's using your wetlands, et cetera. Is we did one of the night studies out here for deer. Mm-hmm. And the amount of deer that were out in the units eating primrose and smartweed was crazy to me in the middle of winter out in the wetland units.
Yep.
Wet, you know, and just eating on the plants. And I was like, would have never thought that. I thought, like, we're just going to see them on the roads. But they're in the wetland units, like right in the middle of winter.
Oh, yeah.
Which is nuts.
And that, you know, starts to get a little kind of the thing Andy brought up about wildlife diversity, you know, is that also driven? You've got all this contouring of your wetlands where you have different plants in different areas. So you start getting the plant diversity. Is that driving wildlife diversity? Who's using what? Mm-hmm. I see a lot of that mare's tail, which I see some management plans that are like, oh, you want to get rid of some of this stuff. And what's really funny is if you walk out right about now in some of these units that have been drawn down, I'll be doing veg surveys and you'll see the mare's tail plant just nipped off and it looks like the deer have been going through and biting yeah. those plants selectively.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show how having a multitude of different things can be so beneficial to the wetland. So,
yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, wetland management requires you to be out there and observe. If you're observing things and no matter what you do, it's going to be a positive. It may be a short-term negative, long-term positive, short-term positive, long-term mm-hmm. negative. But as long as you're manipulating, moving soil in 20 to 25% of every unit every year, you're going to have some diverse moist soil plants and macroinvertebrate that are going to benefit wildlife species. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, from my perspective and what I've learned is, do as much disturbance as you can in the fall. It makes your spring and summer next year a lot easier.
Right.
To manage. Yeah.
And I'll say that, notice, Andy, I don't think you mentioned ducks in that entire sentence. So I think kind of the big thing for me that's I've learned over the last 4 years is that, you know, we tend to get hyper-focused on our, like, what our individual product is that we want. You know, more duck habitat, more duck hunting. And that drives, you know, funding. So I totally understand that. But there's other groups out there and, you know, I think this, it gets into taking a systems approach. So ecosystem approach to management, as opposed to trying to focus on one thing where you could get into trouble really quick. So if I could say one thing, it'd probably be that.
Yeah. Well, perfect. Well, we appreciate you guys taking the time out of your busy day to talk with us. I obviously learned a lot and, you guys are a wealth of knowledge and it's always just fun catching up with you guys. So appreciate it.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Good.
Cool.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast.